It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. I'm Keely Boltina, in for Kate Archer Kent. Muslim community members are organizing against racial injustice. They're demonstrating and rallying to talk about the problems they see as people protest nationwide, and they're starting conversations about what needs to happen next. Our guests are two people encouraging Muslims to stand up for what's right. Sumaya Abdi is a protest organizer and a nursing student at UW Milwaukee. Sumaya, thank you for joining us this morning.
No problem. Thank you for having me.
And Othman Atta is the director of the Islamic Society of Milwaukee. Othman, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much, Julie.
And we do have a line for you available to join our conversation about what you see. 800-642-1234. How has the coronavirus pandemic changed how you or your Muslim brothers and sisters worship? Have you participated in a protest against police brutality driven by your faith? Help us understand at 800-642-1234 as we all talk about what this means for us. We should, though, start with the protests. Sumaya, your protest against police brutality, you helped organize this. It brought attention to the deaths of George Floyd, of Breonna Taylor, other people of color who have died at the hands of police. Why did you decide to step up and organize this?
I think it's a matter of why not? Why should we not stand up? You know, if we have platforms, if we have voices, we should let everyone know how we feel and that, you know, this isn't right as a country. We shouldn't be supporting this. And I feel like as youth, as administrators, as government officials, we all should have a say and, you know, give our opinions and let our voices be heard about the injustices happening in our communities and our states.
How did you know, though, that you needed to step up and organize? I think a lot of people are saying we need to do something about this, but not everyone is taking a leadership role in this. And you're 19, right?
Yeah, I'm 19.
So what about this moment said, I need to organize this, I need to lead here, when there are so many people right now actually speaking up about the same thing?
I feel like, you know, we see all these protests happening and you just kind of question, you know, hey, I'm in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, you know, why can't I do it? So, like, it was kind of like Dana brought up, my other co-organizer, Dana Shalawi, she brought it up and we're like, hey, this would be a good idea. And we could show the families of all the ones who've lost, you know, lives, police brutality, that, hey, you know, our city supports you guys. We hear you guys. Our religion supports you guys. And we hear you guys.
The protest that you organized, how did you think it turned out?
I actually thought it was a great turnout. I wasn't expecting that many people. You know, there's people like different colors, different races, ethnicities, religions, backgrounds. And, you know, everybody was just there to make their voices heard and to get their points across that, you know, this isn't right.
Sumaya, how did your faith play into this work?
Our faith, like, always kind of tells us, you know, like, all humans, God created every single human equally, you know, and that, like, if one, we kind of represent this metaphor where, like, if one part of the body's in pain, then, you know, the whole body's in pain, and we embody that as, like, a community. You know, if one part of our community is in pain, we're also in pain. So it's our duty to speak up and, you know, do anything in our ability to help out or, you know, let our voices be heard.
Othman, were people who are part of the Islamic Society of Milwaukee participating in this march that was organized?
Absolutely. As Sumaya mentioned, we had people coming in from different backgrounds, different races, different ethnicities, and even, you know, different segments of society. There were physicians that actually left their work and came in, and there were business people and, you know, just students and many others. So it was really an awesome, protest, and Sumaya and Dana did a great job.
You mentioned the diversity of people in the crowd, and yet this is organized because people of the Muslim faith are saying we need to do something now. So how does the experience of that religion really influence the decisions that people make when they decide to stand up or to stay quiet?
You know, I think that the Muslim community has itself experienced some, you know, discrimination and racism and bigotry, especially post 9/11. And unfortunately, even at the highest levels of this administration. So we have a really small kind of taste of what has been experienced by the African-American community. Clearly, the African-American community, they've been experiencing it for centuries, much more serious discrimination and racism and bigotry. But I think that the Muslims said, you know, look, we need to stand out. We need to, you know, kind of come out and express our support for any kind of racism that exists. And the most enduring, longest-lasting racism, unfortunately, in this country has been the racism against the black community.
We are talking with Othman Atta, who is the director of the Islamic Society of Milwaukee. We also have Sumaya Abdi here, who's a protest organizer and also a student in college. And we're taking your calls at 800-642-1234. Did you take part in the protest march in Milwaukee last Wednesday that was organized by members of the Islamic Society of Milwaukee? What pushed you to turn out? Maybe you had to miss it. What do you think about the protests, and how would you like to see people of the Muslim faith influence what's happening right now? Give us a call at 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. Sumaya, what did you hear from other people who attended the protest? What was the response?
Everybody had a positive feedback. Everyone was really happy about the turnout. Like, you know, they're happy that we put this all together and that we just, you know, we wanted everybody to be there and support.
And do you have a crowd estimate or understand what people are going to do now that protest is done, but there's still work to do?
Yeah, I've been getting, like, texts and messages and stuff like that where people are like, you know, because there's, like, so many black lives that have been taken, and just, the list just keeps going and new names keep appearing. And everybody just, like, is in this thirst for, like, justice. And people, like, you know, some people want to make protests. I know some people are trying to do murals and stuff like that. Everybody just wants to see the change now that we're actually seeing some sort of change.
So the protest is certainly not an isolated event. Things need to keep up the momentum, I guess, Sumaya.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And Othman, has the Milwaukee Muslim community participated in other protests? Is this something that your members typically do?
I mean, over the year, we've participated in all kinds of different protests with many different groups. There was, for example, Voces de la Frontera. There were protests with, you know, peace groups against legislation, you know, that we may have opposed. So the Muslim community has been involved in protests. This one with the Black Lives Matter, this is something I think that the Muslim community has said we really need to get involved more in this. And to kind of build up on what Sumaya was saying, I mean, the protests are one thing, and I think that anyone who witnessed the murder of George Floyd could not but feel that they had to do something. And the same thing when we saw what happened to Ahmaud Arbery and Breonna Taylor. I mean, if you're human, you have to act. And so it's not just the protests. I think it's moving beyond to talk to legislatures, to talk to city councils, to actually implement change, to make the needed institutional changes that would prevent these kind of things from taking place, and that would really promote a much greater equality for our black brothers and sisters.
Othman Atta is the director of the Islamic Society of Milwaukee, and we're also talking with Sumaya Abdi, who's a protest organizer and a college student. We are taking your calls at 800-642-1234, wondering how the pandemic has affected Ramadan or other practices in your experience of worship. This is The Morning Show. Here on the Ideas Network, we hear from people who are struggling with not being able to gather together. From family celebrations to national holidays, staying apart to slow the spread of COVID-19 can be difficult. That's true, too, for people of faith who pray and worship together by intention. We're talking about it with two people who are Muslim. This is The Morning Show. I'm Keely Boltina in for Kate Archer-Kent, and we are taking your calls at 800-642-1234. How has this pandemic changed how you or people you know practice faith? How has it changed your Friday prayer practice? Or what questions do you have about mosques still being closed or plans for how they'll reopen? 800-642-1234. You can also tweet us at WPR Mornings. Othman Atta is the director of the Islamic Society of Milwaukee. He and Sumaya Abdi are our guests. She's a protest organizer and a nursing student at UW-Milwaukee. And Othman, from the end of April through almost the end of May, we saw Muslims around the world taking part in Ramadan. And for those unfamiliar with Ramadan, remind us what it is.
Well, Ramadan is actually the name of the ninth month of the Muslim calendar. It's a month where Muslims fast, do not consume any food, beverages, anything from basically dawn to dusk. And for the Muslim community, it's actually probably the most active time of the year. A lot of social activities, a lot of prayers, families getting together, a lot of outreach, especially for the poor, feeding programs and so forth. So it's really traditionally the most busy time of the year for the Muslim community and for Muslim organizations.
And Othman, I do want to say, I'm saying help us understand. And what I'm really saying is, how can we as listeners understand? I certainly want to make sure that we're not creating any additional division. How is Ramadan different this year than how it's traditionally practiced?
Well, because of the closure, we actually closed down our mosques. We ended the five daily prayers in the mosque. All of the special programs that we have during Ramadan were canceled. We tried to move everything online. So, for example, we, during Ramadan, would have a nightly reading from the Muslim scripture. We could not do that because of the closure, so we tried to move it online. The online effort worked. I mean, I think that we were able to engage a large part of the community. People were concerned about not being able to do a lot of the things that they were accustomed to. But overall, I think, given all the difficult circumstances, everything went fine. But what was more important, and this was something from our religious leaders from the beginning, they indicated that safety of people's lives, is much more important than anything else, including prayers and other things, like, you know, congregational meetings and programs. And so the emphasis that our religious leaders, in consultation with physicians and others, was, look, we will not put anyone at risk, not from our community, not the community at large. And so we had to do things differently. And I think overall what we were able to do worked out fine. I think that people appreciated it. And the silver lining was many people were actually able to spend more time with their families, whether in worship or just in conversation. And so there was a bit of a silver lining to it as well.
That idea, though, that staying safe, staying healthy is more important than some of the really critical traditions of Ramadan. I mean, I don't think you have to be Muslim to understand that people who are devout might take issue with that. I mean, how did you talk with people about that so that they understood the importance of public health and that it didn't necessarily conflict with their beliefs?
You know, there's in every community, among every faith, you're going to have those individuals who kind of have a fatalistic attitude. It's like, oh, you know, God will take care of us. And unfortunately, that's the wrong kind of attitude. What our religious leaders made very clear that according to, religious requirements, the preservation of life and safety and security actually takes precedence over any kind of worship services. And so that message was made very clear with many examples given from, the Islamic scriptures and, historically and so forth. So I think that we got the message out loud and clear. And in fact, we actually are still closed. We have a committee that includes religious leaders and physicians and other experts, and we're kind of putting together a program of how we will open. For example, everyone will have to wear masks. There will be social distancing. We have a ritual washing that usually takes place. That will be canceled at our centers. They will have to do that at home so that we don't put people at risk. Again, even till now, the priority is safety and security for everyone, because even if people come to pray, they're going to still go out to their families, to the community, and we want to make sure that we're not spreading that virus to others. And so that's the priority.
And Sumaya, how has the pandemic affected your religious practices this year? What do you see yourself doing differently?
I guess the whole Masjid shutdown was kind of something that we had to get used to, because since Ramadan, most of our religious practices are at the mosque. So we kind of had to reset ourselves and kind of make everything at home. And I feel like, especially within Muslim communities, we're very social like creatures. Like, we love going to each other's houses or, you know, to the mosque. And we kind of had to get used to not be doing that, you know, in order not to endanger anybody. So that was kind of something new. But I feel like it wasn't as hard as I thought it would be.
Why did you think it would be hard?
Just like, this is kind of like a first time for everybody, you know, like in all my 19 years, you know, Ramadan was always at the masjid, all my prayers, you know, Friday prayers, everything was always at the mosque or within people. And now suddenly, you know, I was closed off only into my house. So I thought that was going to be like really hard to get used to. And I'm sure other people felt the same way.
Sumaya Abdi is a protest organizer, also a nursing student at UW Milwaukee. We're also talking with Othman Adda, who's the director of the Islamic Society of Milwaukee. And Sumaya, we talked about the fact that you organized this protest. And I wonder, as we're talking about the pandemic, what kind of precautions did you and other protesters take to stay safe from the coronavirus while also standing up in this way?
Yeah, we definitely had to consider like the pandemic and its effects into our protest. So like when I made the flyer, I said, oh, you know, we have to have like mandatory face masks and social distancing within like, you know, the protest. And everybody just kind of had to remind themselves, you know, to like the effects of the pandemic and stuff like that.
So there was a balance. Did people show up protecting themselves?
Yeah, majority of the people showed up with their masks and or cloths or something kind of that nature. Sorry, and we kind of just, you know, kept our distance and stuff like that.
Sure. And I guess more to protect other people when you wear the mask so that you don't infect others if you happen to have, you know, this really contagious disease. And Othman, whether it's because of the pandemic or these protests, we've heard from faith leaders calling for solidarity across religions so that we can heal as a community, as a country. How will we work toward that?
I think we just have to put more effort into it, especially in reaching out to government officials. I mean, the Islamic Society has now for years were involved with the Interfaith Conference of Greater Milwaukee. We have a center in Brookfield, which is part of the Brookfield Elm Grove Interfaith Network. We're involved in, other organizations, including MICA in the central city of Milwaukee and other things. I think we need to, as different people of different faith communities, we all recognize and appreciate the diversity that of humans, and we all have as part of our beliefs that we are equal and that everyone should be treated equally and with respect. I think, though, that we have to move beyond just speaking among ourselves and agreeing that, yeah, this is what we all believe in, to really push together for real change in the society, in whether it's regarding how the police is structured, to some of the institutional racism that exists. How do we get beyond that? The African-American community and the civil rights movement, actually a lot of groups, including Muslim groups, have actually benefited from the struggles that the African-American community has went through over, decades and even centuries. But for the civil rights movement, obviously, for decades. But we need to make sure that those changes, those improvements also are improvements that will be seen by the African-American community, that they will feel much more comfortable, that they won't feel a hesitation, you know, going out, whether it's jogging or anything else in society. I mean, just the fear that they are experiencing the bigotry and the racism that exists in institutions. We have to work together as religious communities and people with no religion at all. It doesn't matter. We have to all work together on making those changes and improvements.
Othman, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much, Kevin.
And Sumaya, thank you. We appreciate your time.
Thank you for having me.
Sumaya Abdi is a protest organizer and a student, and Othman Atta is the director of the Islamic Society of Milwaukee. And we should say later today, the funeral of George Floyd is taking place at the Fountain of Praise Church in Houston, Texas. Floyd's killing in Minneapolis has sparked worldwide protests. Join us for live coverage as he's laid to rest in his hometown. That's today at 11 o'clock right here on Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks for joining us on the Ideas Network. Come with us as we hop on social media. When we see a message on Twitter, we can quickly share it with everyone following our account by retweeting it. Simple enough action, exponential opportunity for more people to read it and share it with their own followers. So what happens when that message comes from a bot? It's time to find out. I'm Keely Boltina in for Kate Archer-Kent. We're talking about social media bots here on The Morning Show. What they are, how they work, how we figure out their true identity as, well, not a real person. And then we're digging deeper into how these bots change our perception of what's happening in our world. You can join in now at 800-642-1234. Have you noticed bots on your Twitter or Facebook feeds? How have you been able to spot them? And what do you wonder about the research? 800-642-1234, or you can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Our guest is Kathleen Carley. She's a professor at Carnegie Mellon University, who is director of both the Center for Informed Democracy and Social Cybersecurity and the Center for Computational Analysis of Social and Organizational Systems. Kathleen, welcome to the Ideas Network.
I am glad to be here.
We should probably start by explaining exactly what a social media bot is.
So a bot is simply a computer program that can do things for you. So some of them are set up, for example, to take any tweet you give it and to just simply retweet it like every hour. Other ones are set up to engage and chat back and forth with people repeating common phrases.
So bots can chat with people?
Yes.
And so then how are people using them on social media?
Well, they're actually used in a huge number of ways. Many bots are just used for marketing purposes to just simply make sure that a group or an individual's brand gets out there, gets repeated, you know, gets mentioned a lot. Other ones are actually used to build groups and build communities by mentioning a bunch of individuals and then getting, you know, the platforms to then prioritize things for those other individuals. Bots can also just follow individuals and make them look more important than they are. They can make topics trend. So they're used in many, many ways.
So there are bots that are really boosting the popularity of real human accounts, real accounts. But then there are these more, I guess, nefarious ways that bots can be used against us as users.
Yes, but they can also be used in ways that can help you as users.
Tell me more.
So, well, the exact same technology that can be used to send out a message making you think that everybody in your group believes something that's not true, that exact same technology can be used to, for example, warn you that a tsunami is coming.
Okay, so bots aren't inherently bad. They can just,
no.
They can be used either way.
Exactly.
So you conducted a recent study analyzing more than 200 million tweets that address the coronavirus between January and May. What did the research show?
So our research showed that, our research suggests that there are a huge number of bots that are taking part in the discussions around the coronavirus. They're used in a large number of ways. Some of them are simply retweeting news articles. Some of them are sending, you know, retweeting whatever the World Health Organization, whatever says. But there's other bots that are focused around what we call black news sites, sites that are known to send disinformation, that what they're doing is just sending out messages pointing people to those sites. Other ones are rebroadcasting information from state-sponsored media, such as from China or Russia. So they're doing a whole bunch of things.
So while they may be spreading things from the WHO or the CDC, it sounds like your study also found that there were more than 100 types of inaccurate COVID-19 stories that are identified, things like potential cures that just aren't true that are spreading because of the bots.
Well, they're also spreading because of humans. So both bots and humans will spread things. So, yes, we found a huge number of different stories. Many of them are inaccurate cures and inaccurate preventions. Other ones of these are false stories about measures the governments were taking to engage in lockdown or to reopen. You know, other ones were just silly stories, such as because of lockdown, there was less pollution in Venice, so the canals were now clean and there were now dolphins and swans going around.
Right, things that just weren't true, even if they were feel good.
Exactly.
Would you expect this amount of bot activity in other places? Is it typical all the time, or would we see it for something like a natural disaster or an election? How do we figure out what the norm is?
So you don't. Well, in our studies, we have found more bots around political events like elections than we have during natural disasters, although you will see some there as well. We also will see a few around like certain types of new movies, but we don't see them around absolutely everything. So there's way fewer, for example, in certain groups like the plane spotters. So it kind of depends on the kind of group you have, whether or not you will see a lot of bots.
And how do you figure out if an account is someone who just likes to retweet a lot or if you're dealing with a bot?
It's actually really, really difficult. And the way we figure out if something is a bot is we actually built these bot hunting tools. They're machine learning tools. And what they do is they use tons and tons and tons of data. And they've been trained on data where some human has said, I think this is a bot, I think it isn't. And it tries to find other, you know, actors out there that look like that data. So it's a statistical technique. And it doesn't actually say this is a bot. What it says is here's the probability that it's a bot. So because it's very hard for, as I mentioned, for humans individually to actually figure these things out on their own. There are some tells like, you know, high levels of tweeting or having just a string of numbers for a name or having a gender mismatch between the image and the physical name, changing the name frequently. Things like that are common to bots, but just because they're common doesn't mean a human doesn't ever do them.
Sure. Okay. We are talking with researcher Kathleen Carley, a professor at Carnegie Mellon University and director of the Center for Informed Democracy and Social Cybersecurity. And we're taking your calls at 800-642-1234. Have you seen friends or family share messages that you suspect were generated by fake accounts? How have you tried to address those? How did you even figure out that you thought maybe this has come from a place that is not good with its reputation or that might not be trusted? How are you thinking that social media companies should handle this? You can give us a call now at 800-642-1234. You can also tweet us. We're on Twitter at WPR Mornings. Kathleen, now that we know kind of how you try to identify these bot messages analyzing the tweets and also when they are sent and if they're in the same country, those sorts of things, how do we think that the bot messages about the coronavirus are affecting public dialogue?
Well, that's a very good question. It's very hard to tell at this point because when we haven't spent a lot of time figuring that out, what we can see so far is that bots are more likely to be spreading the information from these, you know, black news sites than are human beings. So although that's a very small amount of the coronavirus dialogue, that part of the dialogue that, for example, say it's a bioweapon or whatever, is much more bot-driven than, say, the stuff about real cures.
Okay. So they're more likely to kind of traffic in this misinformation?
Well, in that particular kind of misinformation. Whereas misinformation like that, if you drink green tea, you won't get coronavirus. That kind of misinformation, we see as many humans as bots, or sometimes even more humans than bots. So the bots are not pervasive across all the different kinds of misinformation, but they're strongest in certain pockets.
Then how do we even begin to tell if what we're seeing on social media is a reflection of what people are talking about?
Well, one thing is to actually look at where people are actually looking at real news, you know, real credible news sources. The stuff, you know, that is stuff that more human beings are sending out, and that is stuff that more human beings are talking about, are the things from the credible news sources. The more extreme something sounds, whether it's more of an extreme cure or more of an extreme government measure, those are often more dominated by bot kind of activity.
And your recent study focused on Twitter. Why that social media platform as opposed to Facebook or Instagram?
Okay. It is not because there are more bots on Twitter. That's not it at all. In fact, we don't know how many there are relative to other platforms. It's simply that Twitter has given better access to people doing research than have many of the other platforms.
So because you have better access to the data there, it makes sense to start there with what you're working on.
Exactly.
And then will you try to study bot activity on other platforms if you can get a hold of the information?
Yes, we're trying to. We're trying to look at it on things like YouTube and Reddit in particular.
All right. We are talking with researcher Kathleen Carley. She stays with us as we discuss the role of automated accounts on social media and how they might play into our conversations with other real people, how they might change our understanding of what the public discussion is on certain topics, especially when it comes to COVID-19. And we're taking your calls. We're wondering, are you worried about the effect that bots might have on our politics or those conversations we have? Do you think social media companies have an obligation to clamp down on this misinformation or spreading of propaganda? What do you think should happen? Maybe you think those alarms about bots are overblown and you don't think they have much of an effect. Give us a call. Let's talk about it together at 800-642-1234. I'm Keely Boltina. This conversation continues here on The Morning Show, and you're listening to The Ideas Network. Automated messages on Twitter make it seem like more people are speaking up about reopening the government than really are. They also peddle cures for COVID-19, which just aren't true. And researchers can't say for sure where they come from, but it appears some bots spreading misinformation on social media are following strategies of Russia and China. This is The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Keely Boltina, and we're talking research into bots with our guest, Carnegie Mellon Professor Kathleen Carley, and with you. There's still a line for you at 800-642-1234. Who do you suspect is pushing fake messages on social media? Have you become more skeptical about what you see on those platforms? Do you notice bots on your Twitter or Facebook feeds? How have you figured out that they're bots? 800-642-1234. And Kathleen, who stands to gain by pushing false narratives on the coronavirus, including the fact that, some bots really focused on supporting reopening of government systems early on?
Okay. Well, some of the bots out there, and this is speaking worldwide, not just in the U.S., are actually and this is a very small percentage of them, are being used to push messages that are trying to effectively divide communities. So, you know, we see this throughout the world. Like, for example, in India, there's ones that are pushing messages that are, you know, disinformation that Muslims were doing things like spitting on food, et cetera, that were basically aimed to increase the divide between the Hindi and the Muslims in those in India. So one of the reasons for bots being used this way is to create just general havoc. One is to create polarization. Other times bots are used to spread a message because some group thinks it would be fun. And so those are some of the reasons that they're used.
And why is it that we can't necessarily trace bots back to specific countries or specific groups, I guess?
So it's, well, attribution is extremely hard because, first off, you can actually buy a service which sells you bots, right? And so first you have to figure out that it's purchased. Then you have to figure out who purchased it, you know. And, of course, there's a whole bunch of ways you can hide money trails. So that's a huge forensics research, you know, kind of investigation in and of itself. Just using, you know, computer tools and looking at the bot itself, most tweets do not have location information. Even if they do link back to an IP, so it's the computer address, you can spoof that. You can make it look like it's somewhere that it isn't. So it's just very, very difficult.
And we mentioned the Russian and Chinese playbooks. There are different ways that different countries try to influence other nations, especially America, when we're looking at this particular time. How is the propaganda that we see pushed by the Russian government different than what we see from China and other governments?
So in our studies, what we've seen is that Russia does a variety of different kind of things. One, it has a standard practice where it will actually place bots and other actors embedded in, it'll pick any divide, okay, at all, such as, you know, Republican, Democrat, anti-vax, pro-vax, pick your divide. It'll place actors on both sides of a divide, and it'll, those will then try to build connections, make those groups denser, more talking to each other. And then once you get them more dense talking to each other, they'll start spreading messages on one side on dismay and one side on excite, thus building polarization and making both sides more echo chamberish so that they become more, so that people get angrier or more excited in these events and then more likely to take their action offline. The other thing that's a very standard Russian tactic. Another Russian tactic is just to try to distort things by sending out totally different messages on totally different topics to kind of confuse the issue. So, and the other thing is Russia will use many, many, many different storylines all at the same time. And if they don't work, they say, oh, that was just a joke. Mm. You know, that was just a joke. In contrast, what we've seen with China doing are a little bit more subtle. China will often do things where what they do is they play up, you know, how China is doing so wonderfully, how it is handling things well, how it is supporting others, you know, and it will actually distort things to make them look overly good, if you know what I mean. So it's a very different kind of strategy. You know, and they will, you know, and then they will also then send out messages and doing things that not only make them look good, but they, they don't exactly tolerate things that make them look bad. So those things may get suppressed, you know, if the stream goes through them and so on.
Sure. Kathleen Carley is a professor at Carnegie Mellon University, and we're talking about her research team that's using multiple methods to figure out who is and isn't a bot on social media and what that really means and its effect on the conversations that we have and how we view the world. Kathleen, you mentioned that people, you know, can buy bots, can buy followers, things like that, and that these different organizations will find divisions and exploit them. Is, you mentioned that that's true for ideas, but is that true for people too? I mean, in campaigns, if you've got different candidates up, would we see bots target one or the other?
So Going back to the 2018 elections, we actually saw bots around every single incumbent who was up for election, as well as around their opponents. And sometimes these bots are nothing more than news bots, just simply, you know, re-spreading out, you know, messages about that one. And sometimes they will be attacking, but they're equally used just for spreading whatever that candidate is saying.
So what you're saying is almost every politician has bots that are dedicated to them, for good or for bad.
They're around them. I don't know who put them there.
Sure. Right. Right. Yeah. I mean, this is an incredibly complicated thing, and you're in the work that you're doing. And we do wonder, as we are getting closer to the 2020 election, should we expect that bots will become more active? You said in elections they tend to be.
I would expect that they will either remain at the current level or possibly get more active. But I think it's going to look a little bit different. It's going to look different than it did in 2016 or 2018, in part because the platforms themselves are just so much more active on doing things such as banning the bots that violate the terms of service, or putting up notices that certain types of information are disinformation, things like that. And all of that will change the behavior somewhat. But because these are software programs, the people behind them are also going to be adapting and creating new forms. Although we can't say exactly what they will look like, I'm sure they will be there.
As your research continues, and it is a complicated, deep kind of work that you're doing, what should people, just regular users, be thinking about or looking out for when they're participating on social media? What do you want us to do?
Well, I would say that it's important for, people to keep pestering the government and social media to think about this issue and to try to come up with a joint plan that is consistent with, you know, the moral values of our society. I also think that as individuals, you know, you have to try to be a critical thinker. When you're reading something, don't take it at face value. You know, even if it seems to come from your group, look at credible sources. Look at the kind of source that is credible for that kind of information. So if you want medical information, go to a medical source, for example. And finally, you know, if something looks like it's probably not true, just don't respread it, even if you think it's funny, because those who are paying attention to you may not realize that, may not think it's funny and think it's serious.
Kathleen,
so don't be part of the process.
Thank you so much for that advice. We really appreciate your time explaining it this morning.
Sure, my pleasure.
Kathleen Carley is a professor at Carnegie Mellon University who's director of the Center for Informed Democracy and Social Cybersecurity, sometimes called IDEAS. We're talking about her research on social media and how bots influence real people spreading their messages. Just ahead, we're talking with three Black moms about the fears and challenges of raising Black children in America today, and we'll hear how they're talking to their children about protests against police brutality and systemic racism. I'm Keely Boltina. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.